Founding support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Helles Foundation and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, your weekly look at the Louisiana literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week I'll be talking with J.M. Redman about her new book in the Mickey Knight series. It's called The Smallest Day. J.M. Redman has chronicled LGBTQ life in her adopted hometown of New Orleans in a diverse body of work. She's best known for her 12-volume Mickey Knight series, featuring a tough protagonist with a soft and easily broken heart. The most recent in the series, Transitory, won the Publishing Triangle Joseph Hansen Award, a Golden Crown Award, and was nominated for a Lambda Literary Award. She is the editor with Greg Heron of three anthologies, including the award-winning Night Shadows, Queer Horror. And she did all this while working at a demanding day job at No AIDS Task Force, now known as Crescent Care. Jean has retired now, and luckily for us, she's writing more. And her new book in the Mickey Knight series is The Smallest Day. Unluckily for us, she's moved to Milwaukee, where we're speaking to her today, but she's still writing about New Orleans. Jean Redman, welcome back to The Reading Life.
Thank you so much, Susan. It's always good to talk to you and talk to you about reading your books.
You can take the girl out of New Orleans, but you can't take New Orleans out of the girl.
No, I could say that New Orleans is the city of my heart and my soul.
Yeah.
You know, Milwaukee was a practical move. My wife is tenured up here at the university, and so she's still working. It made sense for us to combine everything. But I will miss New Orleans till the last breath in my life. I try to come back as often as I can.
Well, have you set up a writing routine in Milwaukee? I mean, are you comfortable and, you know, in a groove?
Yeah, pretty. You know, I usually get up in the morning and you know, play with cats a little bit because one just has to, and then the coffee breakfast. And then the mornings are sort of like emails and this sort of stuff, and I have to answer this and fill out this whatever, and then a little bit of lunch. And then in the afternoon, I usually write for a couple of hours.
And you've made it through a winter.
I have made it through a winter. Well, one of the agreements when I came up here was like, you know, I will not go outside once the snow starts falling. I'm perfectly happy to sit inside and look at it coming, falling through the windows, but I do not have to go out in it.
All right. Seems fair. What a transplant.
Yeah. Yes, indeed.
Now, seriously, I think this may be the best Mickey Knight novel of all of them. And it must have been the toughest to write because it's about such heart of darkness matters as hate crimes and profound grief.
Yeah.
So put us in the picture of Mickey's latest caseload.
Well, Mickey is, she's a private eye in New Orleans, and I try and keep it, you know, somewhat realistic in what she's doing. And so she gets a call because someone needs a kind of security bodyguard. It's a rabbi from New York who hates New Orleans.
Mm-hmm.
It's her least favorite place in the world. She was down there for one Mardi Gras and just absolutely hates it. Someone took a shot at her, and killed her wife, probably intending to kill her. So the assumption is that someone may be out to kill her, and so she's taking some time off away from there, hoping that because no one will think she's going to come to New Orleans. And so it was about, okay, so what's happening with this? A lot of the terror is the I don't know. I don't know what's going to happen. I don't know what's around the corner. Don't know what's going to happen to me. That they don't know, is it some, you know, just nutcake with a gun who took an opportunistic shot and that's it? Is it somebody part of a group that's kind of organized that's decided, hey, she's a Jewish and she's queer and that's, we get two targets in one fell swoop? Is it someone who could target her? So that's some of the anxiety of it that's going on with this.
Now, you give us such a rich character in Rabbi Sarah Jackson, who's grieving the loss of her wife. And
yeah.
Through it all, she keeps bearing witness to her faith.
Well, that was important. important to me. I mean, you know, I don't consider myself a really religious person.
Yeah.
You know, obviously churches have often been very unkind and unwelcoming to the LGBTQ people. But it's also, what is faith and how do we deal with it and how do we hold on to it? And how would someone like that use that faith, the way we deal with the world and the centuries of the world that we're in? I've been to several Shabbat services. You know, I was just recently at the Shabbat Pride. And so I know a fair number of Jewish people. Also, you know, I lived in New York City in my youth and I went to college up there. So again, I suddenly was like, instead of the Southern girls, meeting a lot of Jewish people. And so I've always kind of known them. And one of the catalysts for this book is that my wife went to the University of Pittsburgh, and that's where she got her PhD. And one of her mentors there went to the Tree of Life synagogue, and he was a little late, and he was in the parking lot.
Wow.
Wow. You know, yeah, we hear about all the time the murders and the killings that go on. But this one just felt like, yeah, we can't just keep walking by those. And so that was kind of the genesis for what this book has become, the exploration of how do we deal with that constant low level or sometimes very high level of threat in our lives.
Mm-hmm. Now, one of the most satisfying things about this novel is the way you show what a grieving person needs: time, space, good New Orleans food, yes, a chance to observe rituals. And you have Sarah say Kaddish for her wife with her New Orleans friends, who, of course, yes, Mickey's old friends.
Yeah, and I was very fortunate to have a friend who's a rabbi and her partner who's a cantor. And so I'm not Jewish. And so they really helped me get through a lot of this. What would she do? How would she handle this? And what are the traditions that hold us together? The feeling that, you know, one of the, I think the advantages of traditions like religion, depending on it, is you can go to a church service in different cities and it still feels very same. There's still something to hold on to. You can go to a Shabbat service. And again, there are going to be, I mean, certainly different elements depending on what particular brand of, but there's things to hold on to. And so much of this has dealt with how do we go through the big milestones in life, birth, marriage, the commitment to another person, and also the passing, that people leave us. And the grief, I think one of the things that the Jewish ceremonies do well is they have a specific ritual for the year anniversary.
Yeah.
Knowing that that's a big mark, that year of the loss on an ongoing journey that's going to last for the rest of your life.
That is so important to mark these things. So important.
Yeah.
Now, one of the Jewish concepts that you write about so beautifully is one that intrigues me as well, that I love so much, and that's Tikkun Olam.
Yeah.
And I want you to talk a little bit about that.
Well, it's the idea of heal the world. And I think it's true not just for any particular faith, but I would like to think it's true for a lot of us, is how do we make the world a better place, even in the very small, sometimes, ways that we can do it? How do you bring books to people that they wouldn't know about otherwise, in a way that the books get out there, the knowledge gets out there, the things get passed on? How do we look at the world in ways that we can make it better? And what choices do we make? And recognizing that sometimes these are very small choices, but they're also very important choices.
Well, I love that saying, you may not complete the work, but neither are you free to abandon it.
Yes, exactly.
You have to move it along.
Exactly. And I think, you know, recognizing now in the situation we're in that there's going to be, we will be passing torches to keep healing the world.
Well, we have to work harder.
And one of the few things I can do is I write books. And like I say, this book was, the idea has been bubbling around for a while, obviously, since it's already out now. But it is still very much pertinent to these times, sadly.
So true. So true. Now, one of the things I admire about these books, and I have from the very beginning, it's the way they show the real work of investigation.
Yeah.
You know, what's the paperwork like? The computer work, surveillance, tracking cars, talking to all different kinds of people.
Yeah.
So, you know, Mickey's, you know, she's got a gift for getting along in the world and getting what she needs from people.
Yeah, well, she's fictional, so I can sort of give it to her in a way that life doesn't always hand it to the rest of us. But I've always tried to make it you know, I recognize that that stories are not just real life, because we have real life, we're living in it. But stories want us to take real life and sort of sort it out and make it into something plausible and have the story that brings us along to it. So I always wanted to make Mickey as realistic as I could. And I actually got a review from one of my earlier books from a reviewer who actually was a private eye in real life. Yeah, and you know, it's really great for her to say that I got a lot of it right, which is good because I'm not a private eye. I can read about it. I can research. I can do all these things. I can think, okay, if I wanted to find this out, how would I do it? You know, what kind of technology is there out there that's available and all this sort of stuff? You know, so really recognizing the kind of work it takes to dig into things. And, you know, you don't see all the hours that you're just sitting staring at a computer screen or going through paper or watching video footage, you know, but I tried to make it sort of aware that this is happening. It's not just, oh, you know, quick deduction and luck. There's no Nancy Drew going on here.
But, you know, I bet you could pass that private eye license exam in a heartbeat. I mean,
Well, I'd hope to, yes.
Now, in addition to that, there's the moral considerations that go along with this kind of work. You know, for example, when you're someone's bodyguard, what are your moral obligations? What do you owe your protectee?
Well, yeah, and Mickey obviously wrestles with that because, you know, at the beginning she's like, oh, yeah, well, you're paying me pretty well, but you're not paying me well enough to take a bullet. You know, I'm gonna live to testify if that happens. Again, what do you owe to other people, and what do you owe to other people in this particular situation where it kind of is a commercial arrangement, but obviously it's so much more fraught than that because clearly there is real danger. Somebody's already been killed, and the fact that she could well be targeted, and if Vicky's standing next to her, she's in the target zone. So it's finding that balance between what Mickey's morals are and what the Rabbi Sarah's morals are. Because at one point, you know, Sarah says, don't use the gun. And Mickey is, I can't promise not to do that.
Yeah. Well, the thing about Mickey is that she can save your life, find the best po' boy, and take you out for a night of drag bingo.
Well, yeah, of course.
That is why we love her.
Well, isn't everybody in New Orleans do that?
I do love the comic relief in this book.
Okay, well, good.
What is it like for you to write about New Orleans now that you're not lifting your eyes and seeing it on the horizon?
It's harder because it's, you know, I do a lot of, you know, the online stuff and Street View and all this kind of stuff to remind myself of what's, you know, not only what was there, but also kind of what's changed, because some of it has changed since I moved away. And it's also, it makes me a bit homesick. It's sort of like, oh, I'm probably never going to drive that road again. Or will I ever do this? Or, oh, my God, that sounds like a good restaurant, but I don't live there, so maybe I can get there in my, you know, one or two time trips down there a year. I hope I live there long enough that I'm never going to really lose it. Mm-hmm. You know, things like I still get some of the weather notices because I still have NOAA Ready on my phone. Because it gives me a sense of a rhythm of, oh, my God, it's really raining down there a lot. Oh, my God, it's gotten a lot hotter down there. I try and sort of keep up and obviously, you know, keep up with my friends, Greg and stuff. And we email about every week or so and go down there for Saints and Sinners every year. And I'm going to be down there for BoucherCon this year in early September.
Oh, that's great.
You know, yeah. So sort of get my just sort of renewal of, oh, yeah, this is New Orleans. But I do terribly miss it. I miss, you know, going to my house and just, you know, this is my house. This is where I live. I live, you know, in this historic 1870s house, which, of course, I had to sell. I moved up here. And so it's a little bit harder. It pulls me back into the city and makes me miss it more.
Do you think you'll ever write about Milwaukee?
No. I mean...
No.
Not that it's not worth writing about, but I just don't know it the way I know New Orleans. You know, because it wasn't just that I lived there as an adult. My dad was a New Orleans native. So we would always come over. We lived out on the Mississippi Gulf Coast, which is where Ocean Springs. And so we would go over to New Orleans, you know, every couple months. We'd go out and stay with some of his relatives. Every single REDMANN in the New Orleans phone book is probably some degree of cousin to me. So even young, I had very much a connection to the city. You know, it was, oh, my God, we're going to go to the big city. It's going to be exciting. You know, we would pull into the D.H. Holmes parking lot, we would usually stop there because my dad liked to get the turtle soup. And then we could sometimes wander around the French Quarter. We'd go uptown to visit, you know, that sort of stuff. So there was always this feeling of that's the big, exciting city, even as a child growing up.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Jean Redmond. Her new mystery in the Mickey Knight series is The Smallest Day. I also wanted to ask you about your work all these many years judging novels for the Pinkley Prizes for crime fiction. Because you have done yeoman service for that.
So. Oh, it's been my privilege. I love doing it. Sometimes, it takes a little time to get the books read, particularly when I was working. But it also just pushes me to read books I probably wouldn't read. Mm-hmm. And it also gets me in contact with such a great bunch of people.
Did it do anything for your writing, do you think?
You know, every book I read does something for my writing. I think, you know, I can't always pinpoint it. Mm-hmm. And I think with judging, particularly some of the, sometimes a bad book, I don't want to say a bad book, sometimes a book that is not as perfect as it could be or as you want it to be, helps me look at, okay, they didn't quite get They missed the plot a little bit. They didn't quite, you know, get the climax, the timing right. And it makes me think about, well, how do I make sure I do that better?
Yeah. How do I put the pieces together?
Yeah.
So what's next? Are you already into the next Mickey Knight novel?
I'm not sure what I want to write about yet. I've got a few ideas, but nothing is really coalesced into a book. You know, books aren't just you sit down in front of the computer and you start writing. A book, I feel like I have to have kind of a book in my head, mm-hmm. and I have an idea of the book and what I want to do with it, and then that's when I'm ready to start writing. I will have a short story. There's the Bouchercon Mystery Conference has an anthology, and I got a short story in that, which is a Mickey Knight story. It's the Curious Case of the Sad Trombone. So
that's story great.
Out. There's another anthology that's coming out also in September, which is Crime Inc. It's about queer writers. And so it's an anthology of some of the best queer crime writers that are going on today. And so I had a story in that's coming out. It's also a Mickey Knight story. They asked us to do tribute to icons, and so I picked the writer Ellen Hart. Because she's been incredibly supportive. And so I said, well, what happens if Mickey ends up in Minneapolis?
Oh, how great.
Because I thought that would be fun. So I, you know, short story about that. Rob Burns and I collaborated on not a short story. At this point, it's a long story, but it ended up being about 16,000 words. And so we're like, well, you know, no anthology wants that big chunk. So we talked to our publisher, and they're going to bring it out as kind of a one-off story type thing. So that's fun because it's Mickey Knight meets Rob Burns, Miscreant Crooks, Tansen and Grant.
Oh, my God. We're going to get Rob Burns to publish something, whether he likes it or not.
We are. It is on the schedule. It is. We have to have the final in by November. It's going to come out sometime in the next year. I just got we need all your frontis cover, this sort of stuff from the publisher. And I'm like, yeah.
Do not take up with Jean Redmond if you're a procrastinator.
Yeah. So absolutely. Rob will actually be publishing something next year.
Well, it's always been such a great thing you do to knit in the community with the isolation of writing, because you're really supportive and really strong within that community.
Well, it's what we have to do again, you know, how do we make the world a better place? And there are small ways, but just being, you know, there are a lot of books out there. There are a lot of different writers, and they are not competition to me because they're not going to write my books. Mm-hmm. And so supporting them and the way that the support that I've gotten is kind of like, you just pass it on. You know, make sure we are stronger together.
Amen. Amen to that. Well, we've been talking with J.M. Redmond, whose new novel in the Mickey Knight Mystery Series is The Smallest Day. Don't miss it. Jean, thank you so much.
And Susan, thank you so much. You are very much part of this supportive community.
Aw, thanks. The last time we spoke with Jean Redmond was in 2024. Her novel, Transitory, went on to be a finalist in the LGBTQ+ mystery category in the prestigious Lambda Literary Awards. Here's how she described Mickey Knight then. So as we know, whenever we latch on to a mystery series, it's partly because of the protagonist's life. And Mickey's, you know, she's not exactly on an upswing these days. So tell the reader about how her life is going at this moment.
When I first started the series, you know, it was kind of as, I want to write the kind of book I want to read. And then I had to pull back and say, well, what kind of lesbian would become a private eye and live that kind of life? And so then I had to think, you know, well, she probably didn't have, you know, a great childhood, you know, that sense of being a loner, feeling like you need to take on the world because the world was never fair to you when you were growing up. So I had to create someone who is struggling with some demons. As Faulkner said, the past is never past. It's past is never gone. It's not even past. Mm-hmm. And I think that's true for many of us. So I felt like, okay, what do I do with this character? And I tried to be as realistic about some of the struggles that people have, the demons that we fight, because one of the interesting things to me is how do we find justice when we're very imperfect people? Mm-hmm. How do we choose to do the right thing instead of the expedient thing or the comfortable thing? And how do people, even when they're flawed and messed up and being pulled in different directions, how do we make those kind of choices? And I wanted to make her the kind of person who will stumble and fall sometimes and not always make the right choices, but usually manage to pull through by the end of it. And I've also had her age, because she shouldn't get out of it.
We all are.
Fortunately for her, she is fictional, so I can be a little bit gentler in how quickly the years pass for her. They're not as relentless as every single anniversary. It's another year. So she's starting to confront some of the later middle age crises of where am I with my life. You know, she was in a relationship, it fell apart. Does she want another one? You know, what does she want to do? You know, and as she said, I think at one point in the book, is it too late to ask these questions?
Yeah, that's a question everybody asks eventually too, you know?
Yeah.
So this book begins with a spectacular act of violence. And it's really a terrible reminder of how close street violence is to all of us in New Orleans today and everywhere. And accompanying that violence is an act of profound disrespect for the victim that pushes Mickey into action. This is really a stirring opening. It's really so powerful, that moment. So I want you to talk a little bit about writing that.
Well, you know, books take a long time to write. You know, well, for me, I don't sit down in front of a computer and say, oh, let me start a book and figure it out. As you mentioned, I did retire from my day job, but my day job was working at what was No AIDS Task Force and is now Crescent Care. And I oversaw the prevention department, which did a lot of work with the community, and particularly the LGBTQ community. And about 5 or 6 years, 7 years ago, I think, we were part of a study that with the CDC looking at behavioral risk factors for what they call vulnerable populations. And we were given funding to look at the transgender population in New Orleans, which, you know, I am part of the LGBTQ community, but we all live different lives and there are different ways of looking at it. So we ended up really doing some deep dives into the New Orleans transgender community. And I started writing this book before it was so much of a headline, when it was just sort of that we're seeing the violence against transgender people, particularly African-American transgender women. And it's getting sort of dismissed, like they're dismissible people. And I felt really angry that anyone should be dismissed. And I felt like I can tell stories and maybe I should work at telling this story. It's scary for me because, again, I am not a transgender individual. But I felt like if we don't imagine, if we don't write about things, if we aren't willing to say it, we aren't willing to look at it, then we leave the stories to only the people who are stuck living in them. If those of us can't say, hey, people unlike me are important, and as a writer, I need to push myself to try to be a good enough writer to write about them and make sure the world includes everybody that should be included.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Sue Strachan signs The Obituary Cocktail, Friday, July 18th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Father-daughter team Gary Alipio and Melina Alipio, illustrator, sign Craziest Cajun Football Tale, Saturday, July 19th at 11 at Octavia Books. Author and visual artist Kini Ibura celebrates the release of her YA novel, Tempest, Saturday, July 19th from 1 to 3 at Blue Cypress Books. Coming up, to celebrate the book and current exhibition, Hoatai, Flower Hands, at the Ogden Museum of Southern Art, the museum hosts a conversation with author E.M. Tran, whose book, Daughters of the New Year, is this year's One Book, One New Orleans selection. Megan Holt, executive director of One Book, One New Orleans, and Flower Hands curator Uyen Din appear with Tran at the Ogden Museum Saturday, July 26th at 2 p.m. The event is free and open to the public, but pre-registration at the Ogden Museum website is requested. Mark your calendar and get tickets now for The Last Laugh, Wit, Wisdom, and 10 Years of the Walker Percy Weekend, coming up September 19th and 20th in St. Francisville. Headquartered at Conundrum Bookstore, the weekend includes panel discussions, a lunchtime book club, a progressive front porch tour and bourbon tasting, the Taste of South Supper, as well as an appearance by musician Sonny Landreth. Organizers say this is likely the last time they'll be producing this event, so if you love Walker Percy, this is the time to go. For more information, visit walkerpercyweekend.org. Founding support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Hellis Foundation, the Jefferson Parish Public Library, and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Any views, findings, conclusions, or recommendations expressed in The Reading Life do not necessarily represent those of the National Endowment for the Humanities. The theme song for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by George Ingmeyer and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at WWNO.org. And you can email us at thereadinglife@WWNO.org.